Today, a dramatic escape from Tokyo for a Belarusian athlete and what it tells us about life under President Lukashenko.
Men's 100-meter final. Always an exciting moment. No Usain Bolt, of course, so the chance...
On Sunday, as the world's best athletes were competing on the Olympic track...
Oh, no, Zonnell Hughes, no!
Oh. A bigger drama was taking place elsewhere in Tokyo. Kristina Timanouskaya, a runner from Belarus, had previously criticised her team managers after being entered for a relay she hadn't trained for. A leaked tape appears to show what happened to her next.
She's having an argument with what sounds like a team coach and a member of the Belarusian Olympic delegation. But what's really at stake, you know, in the conversation is actually loyalty. These two officials are browbeating this 24-year-old sprinter into stopping complaining about being put in this race online, and they're telling her basically to go home and shut up. Telling her in these very sinister tones that the more that she kind of goes public about what she's angry about at the team, the bigger the problem is going to be for her. And so they tell her things like, it's like a fly that gets caught in a spider's web. And the more that the fly kind of writhes and turns, the more that it gets entangled. And they say one other thing that I think was maybe even more sinister, and they said, you know, that excessive pride, your excessive pride, it's obvious here, is an extremely dangerous thing to have. And, you know, excessive pride often leads to cases of suicide. For her, you could imagine that this already became a sort of situation of life and death.
What started as an argument about a sporting event has now become an international incident and has thrown a spotlight on the very real danger of speaking out against the authorities in Belarus. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why a Belarusian athlete has become the latest high-profile defection from Europe's last dictatorship. Andrew Roth, you are The Guardian's Moscow correspondent. What can you tell me about Kristina Timanouskaya? You know, what do we know about her before these Olympic Games began?
So she is born in 1996. She's 24 years old now. And Kristina Timanouskaya is from this small town in East Ukraine. And for a long time, you know, for most of her childhood, she wasn't even really involved in sport. She said in an interview, she ran in some district kind of races, but mostly, you know, she was just kind of racing with the boys around the yard and that she usually won. It was only at the age of 15 that she was finally noticed by a kind of athletics trainer in Belarus for being, you know, somebody who really had Olympic potential. And that's when she sort of started to become a rising star in the Belarusian track and field community.
Так, следим за этим забегом и за Кристиной прежде всего. Ой-ой-ой, вы посмотрите. Просто как космический корабль, который выходит на орбиту. Кристина Тимановская пролетает эту дистанцию.
And how had her Olympics been going?
They were her first kind of experience being there at the Olympics. You know, this was a person who had run in kind of international competitions before. But when she got to the Olympics, you know, she started immediately posting a lot of photographs online, not complaining about anything, but just saying, look at me, you know, I'm at the Olympics. Finally, after 5 years, we finally made it here. And, you know, everything kind of depends on us at this point. She hadn't had a ton of success so far at the Olympics. You know, she wasn't in the finals. She hadn't kind of medaled or anything like that. But it was still a sort of a big breakthrough for somebody who, you know, 10 years ago wasn't running, let's say professionally or competitively. and she seemed to expect that she would be coming back for another one.
So, as you say, nothing hugely remarkable about Tymanouskaya's Olympic Games. When did that change?
Late last week, Olympic organizers from Belarus had suddenly at some point decided to enter her into the 4x400 relay, which is a race that, in her own words, that she had never run before. So, faced with this situation, what she did next, I think, was probably the kind of key moment in all of this, which is that Kristina Tymanouskaya decided to go public. And so what she did was she went on Instagram and she wrote a kind of emotional post because of what she called her coach's negligence. She was kind of being forced to compete in a race that she wasn't ready to run. So what had happened was that the people who were supposed to run this relay race weren't able to come to the games because they didn't have the doping tests that they needed. And because of that, Tymanouskaya was kind of being put in as a replacement for these relay runners. But she kind of complained that this was all happening behind her back, that she was never kind of warned about what was going to be happening. She felt that she was being kind of misused as an athlete. So what happened next was that she started to face intense pressure. This is the point at which she had this very emotional argument, conversation with her team coaches and with the Belarusian delegation official, where she was really threatened with a lot of different punishments.
After that, she was removed from the 200-meter race and was told her Olympics were over and she was being flown back to Belarus. What happened when she got to Tokyo Airport? What were the scenes there?
We saw her making a kind of emotional appeal from the airport on video, saying that she was basically being forced to go back to Minsk.
I asked the International Olympic Committee for help. I was put under pressure and they are trying to forcibly take me out of the country without my consent. I asked the International Olympic Committee to intervene.
And I think it's at this point that she made a sort of critical decision that under no circumstances was she going to get on that plane. Under no circumstances was she going to get back to Belarus, and she had to come up with some kind of other plan. So when she gets to the airport, rather than kind of going on and getting on the plane, she decides to appeal to the Japanese police for protection, to say that I'm being kind of forcibly kidnapped or something similar to it. And she starts to get her own story out and to say that I'm looking basically for asylum somewhere else and somewhere in Europe.
And the offers come in very quickly. Both the Czech Republic and Poland publicly say they will help her. What did she decide to do?
At this point, Kristina is still at the airport. Things are still very unclear. Her family is in Belarus, you know, her parents, her grandmother, her husband. And she spends, from what I've been told, this very difficult Sunday night in the airport hotel under police protection from the Japanese police, basically making a decision about where she's going to go into exile. You know, it's become very clear to her that she cannot go back to Belarus at the moment. It's become too dangerous and her story has become too high profile for it to be smoothed over. And so the decision comes down to, you know, one of those countries that's offered her not quite asylum, but refuge and, you know, a humanitarian visa. And she ultimately chooses Poland.
She spent Monday in the Polish embassy in Tokyo. And then yesterday it was reported that she had flown to Vienna. As we record, it's not clear if or when she'll continue to Warsaw. But there's a long history, isn't there, Andrew, of athletes defecting or claiming political asylum at the Olympics from the former USSR and other countries around the world. Does Tymanouskaya's story have echoes of that, do you think?
I think it does to a certain degree. I mean, the idea of athletes kind of being sucked into politics and the Olympics being a kind of venue and a stage for these kind of political dramas to play out and maybe a single chance to kind of get out of the country and escape is similar. You know, Belarus has become so closed at the moment. It's so difficult to get out of the country. And I think the danger for Kristina was very real if she decided to go back. So there is this kind of high profile and extremely high stakes kind of defection taking place. I think at the same time, it's a little bit different, though, for two reasons. First of all, just because I don't think that she planned and ever thought that she was going to have to do this when she went to the games. You know, this wasn't a person who was looking to defect or looking to leave her native country. She was kind of forced into it. And second of all, you know, I don't think that she wanted to get involved in politics like this. It was in many ways a complaint about the sport that kind of evolved into this political discussion that she just couldn't control anymore.
Why does Tymanouskaya not want to go back to Belarus? Like, what is she specifically scared of there now?
In the last year, life in Belarus has transformed completely.
Their dictator has ruled with an iron fist, but after a quarter of a century, most know his feet are of clay. Alexander Lukashenko claimed to have won by a landslide and cast protesters as gangsters. The violence escalated last night.
Now, the main opposition leader in Belarus says she fled the country for the sake of her children after claiming the presidential election result was rigged.
Police in the Belarusian capital Minsk have arrested more than 100 anti-government protesters. They were taking part in another mass demonstration to demand that President Alexander Lukashenko step down.
So we spent a week undercover in Minsk listening to people's stories, to the tales of brutality meted out on so many of the 7,000 detained since the contested election results. Harrowing audio files of the sounds of torture coming from the Okrestina prison, shared across the nation, soundtrack to its trauma.
I mean, since protests began in 2020, there's been a kind of long crackdown on all sectors of society, from opposition politics to NGOs, and that includes sport, for people to really declare their loyalty to the government and Alexander Lukashenko, this president or leader who's been in power for about 3 decades at this point. In Belarus right now, it's really dangerous to be perceived as being in opposition. You know, you can be arrested, you can be tortured. I think that in her case in particular, the danger was that she was so high profile that she would be seen as giving a kind of black eye to the reputation of the country on the world stage at the Olympics. And that she thought that that could mean that people there would want to take revenge against her for what she had done. We've seen, you know, dozens of athletes have been kind of kicked off of teams or taken out of competition because of being in opposition to the government. But there have also been, you know, 20 or so that have been arrested over the last year, have spent time in prison in lice-infested cells following the protests. And a couple of them have also faced kind of attacks personally and physical attacks while they were under arrest. And so the idea that she could be, you know, she could face physical retribution for what she had done, I don't think was out of the question.
She accepted an offer of help from Poland. Is there any significance to that particular country?
Poland has offered her to continue her sports career, which is really important to her. Secondly, is that Poland, along with a few other places, have become real centers of Belarusian life abroad. I mean, this is one of the places where Belarusians who are leaving the country at the moment, and thousands are leaving the country because of what's happening there, are going to basically create these new kind of diaspora lives and create new communities because they feel like they can't live at home anymore. And so we see a lot of Belarusians at the moment moving to Poland, to Warsaw. We see a lot of Belarusians moving to Lithuania. That's where the opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, is based at the moment. She's obviously in exile as well. And we also see a lot of Belarusians moving to Ukraine, to Kyiv as well.
Kyiv, which isn't far from the Belarusian border, may be a place that people can flee to, but it's not necessarily safe. This week, another dramatic story unfolded there. Tell me about Vitaly Shishov and the work he was doing.
So Vitaly Shishov is one of the leaders of the Belarusian diaspora in Kyiv. So this is a Belarusian who's in opposition, who's living abroad. He would run what's called the kind of Belarusian House, which is a sort of community center and advocacy for Belarusians. But more importantly, what he was doing mainly was that Vitaly Shishov was helping Belarusians who had managed to escape the country with financial help, with legal help, and kind of making it possible for them to escape Belarus and kind of move on, you know, move on to the next kind of station, wherever they were going to move to. So he was basically an essential part of, if you wanted to call it a kind of underground railroad or a kind of way for Belarusians to escape the country. At this very important moment this week, with so much attention on Belarus because of the conflict at the Olympics, Vitaly Shishov suddenly disappeared during his morning jog in the park in Kiev. And on Tuesday, he was found hanged in the park with his telephone nearby, reportedly with signs of some kind of conflict or some kind of fight. And a murder investigation has been opened up.
What were the circumstances leading up to his death, Andrew? Like, what do we know?
One thing that had happened in the days leading up to his death is that he had complained that he felt like he was being followed while he was in Kiev by people that he suspected were from the Belarusian KGB.
That's pretty shocking that this is now a murder investigation. How safe do you think Belarusians in Kiev feel right now?
I was speaking with somebody who runs a media website that's openly political, who has a lot of colleagues that are in Kiev. He's Belarusian. His colleagues are Belarusian. And he basically said that I tell them not to be alone, not to put themselves in dangerous situations, because there's always a kind of concern that there could be an attack and that it's a place where we feel a little bit vulnerable, because we know the Belarusian KGB is active there. And we know that that they're very dangerous and that they would target us if they had the chance to.
It is striking that this has happened in the same week that Tymoniuskaya has sought refuge at the Olympics. Is there any link, do you think, we can make between these two events at this stage?
I think it's too early maybe to make a direct link, because the timing is so close. It seems like it would be very quick to launch an operation to attack this person, just based on things that have happened over the last weekend, whereas he said he felt like he was being followed for days before this. That said, this is exactly the kind of person who would have helped Tymoniuskaya or Tymoniuskaya's husband, who had gone through Kiev just yesterday, you know, who spoke with journalists there. He's the kind of person who would have provided help to Belarusians who were going into exile or who were leaving the country. So it's very much part of the same story, which is that the people who dare to run away or to leave the country and the people who dare to help them are very clearly under a lot of pressure and in considerable danger for doing that.
Both of these stories, Andrew, are making me think of something you spoke to us about on the podcast a couple of months ago.
This is not where flight FR4978 was supposed to be this afternoon, on the ground at Minsk Airport. The Ryanair flight with about 170 people on board left Athens this morning bound for Vilnius. But just before the aircraft entered Lithuanian airspace, it suddenly headed east. According to Ryanair, the crew were warned of a potential security threat and ordered to land at Minsk. For good measure, a Belarusian warplane armed to the teeth was dispatched to escort the aircraft in. But no bombs were found on board. Instead, this man was taken off the plane and arrested. Roman Protasevich is a well-known Belarusian opposition journalist and is wanted by the authorities for organising protests last year.
All of this begs the question, is anywhere safe for someone critical of Lukashenko's government?
I think that a lot of these operations are directed at the Belarusian diaspora to show them that they're not safe anywhere. Roman Protasevich obviously felt safe as he was flying from Greece to Lithuania. And the idea that a plane could be grounded just for flying over a small sliver of Belarus had barely crossed, you know, anyone in the opposition's mind until it really happened. The idea of being in Kiev, which is, you know, feels considerably safer than being somewhere like Moscow or in Minsk, the idea that, you know, we can reach you even here is clearly in the same way directed at scaring people who are kind of in the opposition in Belarus, and to show them that, you know, you really have to get a lot further from us if you want to feel like you can create a community or feel safe. And so I feel like, you know, the next step and the thing that European governments are all thinking about at the moment is what's going to happen if a kind of prominent Belarusian activist shows up dead, you know, in Warsaw or in Vilnius or anywhere else in Europe, because it's obviously clear that the KGB, the Belarusian government, is ready to target them pretty much anywhere.
What has happened to Roman Protasevich since he was taken off that flight?
Roman Protasevich has gone through this kind of interesting and pretty harrowing transformation, where it's become pretty clear that the government has decided to use him as a kind of poster child and to kind of put him under enough pressure that they can return him to public life as a kind of loyalist for the Lukashenko government when he's clearly in a hostage situation.
О том, что я вообще хотел уйти из телеграм-каналов, из политических движений и так далее. Я хотел.
So he appeared after the grounding of the plane, maybe a week later, in a press conference, where he, you know, told basically a bunch of journalists, also from opposition media, that he was being treated great, that he shouldn't have been part of the opposition in the first place, you know, kind of recanting all of his former views.
И на этом все, потому что я хотел уйти из этой политики, из этих распри, из этих внутренних игр, потому что мне это всегда было абсолютно чуждо.
Then it got to the point where a journalist stood up and said,
мне сложно представить, Роман, что вы пережили за последние недели.
I can't believe a word you're saying at the moment because you just don't sound like the person that I knew before you got on that plane.
Очень многие ваши коллеги. Всему, что вы говорите, я не верю, потому что, ну, я предполагаю, что сами могли сделать.
Andrew, you said the message that President Lukashenko and the Belarusian government are trying to send through all these different instances is that no one is safe anywhere. Is that message getting through to people in Belarus? And do we have any idea what the mood is in the country at the moment towards the leadership?
I think that in many cases, people in Belarus have had to make a very important choice, which is whether they're willing to live by the new rules in the country, which means much more control over the political scene. You can't say anything bad about the government. You know, speaking out against Lukashenko is risking your job, your freedom. Or leaving the country, voting with your feet, and kind of saying, I can't bear it anymore. I have to get out of here and move on. The most important thing we're seeing from the most committed activists is that, you know, thousands of them have just decided that they have to leave the country. The people who are inside the country, who kind of still see a space to be independent, or, you know, at least not full on loyalist, I think is a really it's a space that's getting smaller and smaller as time goes on. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote about the closure of some NGOs that were doing really good work, including, you know, providing medical care, helping medics who were fighting COVID. They had kind of, you know, helped thousands of people just get access to care, you know, not in an overtly political way. And I spoke with the head of one of them, Katerina Sinyuk, and she said, you know, I have no interest in leaving the country. I want to stay here and I want to help people in a non-political way. And their NGO was closed down, you know, kind of nonetheless. It was seen as still a kind of an arm of external influence.
Coming up, Kristina Timanouskaya has managed to escape. But what does the future hold for her now? Andrew, so much has changed in the last 12 months in Belarus. It's been a year since elections were held there, which led to those huge protests and the opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya fleeing the country. Just this week, she visited Boris Johnson in Downing Street and he gave her his full support. As for Kristina Timanouskaya, what do you think the future looks like for her now?
Her family is still in Belarus, so there's still a kind of lever of control over her. And it's kind of unclear to what degree she's really free because of that. You know, she's always been a person who was a little bit careful about her kind of political views. You know, she had spoken out, but sparingly, I would say, and hadn't taken a really active position. But it will be interesting to see if she becomes more vocal, if she becomes more political, or if what she really wants to do is just to focus on sport. Lastly, of course, she's going to be obviously somebody who's going to be have a lot of pressure on her, have a lot of focus on her from the Belarusian government and KGB. And so I assume that there's always going to be a concern that she could face retribution and that's something she'll live with for a long time.
Andrew, you're in Moscow, but over the last year, you've found yourself reporting on what's been happening in Belarus more and more. This has been a week with two incredibly shocking stories from the country. What do you take away from them?
What I take away from them is basically that this political conflict in Belarus and this question about Lukashenko and his future has really poisoned everything and I think covered everything in the country. You know, the idea of just sticking to the sport, or focusing on that is not possible, because any conflict, any criticism of the government immediately becomes part of something larger. There can't be people abroad in the diaspora who speak out against the government. Belarus is willing to go after them wherever they are, like with Protasevich, to ground planes, to send hit teams, or to threaten people who are abroad as well. We kind of see the sense that the Belarusian government is really willing to do anything at this point, and doesn't really feel concerned about the consequences.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Roth. He's reporting on the latest as this story continues to develop, including the news yesterday that other Belarusian athletes now say they don't feel safe to return home. Find all of his work at theguardian.com. This week, the Belarusian Olympic Committee said that national coaches had decided to withdraw Tymanuskaya from the Tokyo Games on doctor's advice about her emotional and psychological state. On Tuesday, the International Olympic Committee said it had launched a formal investigation into the case and was expecting a report from the Belarusian team. We have previously reported the Belarus National Olympic Committee could not immediately be reached for comment, and it's not clear that it will deliver a report by the IOC deadline. If you want to understand more about what has happened in Belarus over the past year, then I'd recommend going back and listening to two Today in Focus episodes, one presented by Anushka from May called A State-Sponsored Hijacking, the Arrest of Belarus Blogger Roman Protasevich. And from last year, Could a Belarus Protest Movement Bring Down President Lukashenko? Find them wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Elizabeth Kassin. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.